this week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Not under our watch. No attacks on Chairman O'Malley Jatella, the Uhuru movement. We're not going to see a continuation of what happened to Malcolm X and Martin Luther King.
St. Louis, Missouri aldermen are to hold a public hearing with the FBI and the police to demand accountability around the violent militarized raids on the Uhuru movement last summer.
I want to say free Mumia, because now we can save a life. We just lost another life. We won't get that back.
San Francisco International Longshore Workers Union Local 10 will close down all Bay Area ports on February 16th to demand the freedom of political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
New College has been an important part of the Sarasota and greater Florida community since 1960. Like, we can't let this happen without putting up a fight.
In Florida, students at New College are organizing against the hostile takeover of the school's board of trustees by ultra-right-wing Ron DeSantis appointees.
If today election is called for one man, one vote, the current crop of politicians, no one comes back. No one, because these people is being handpicked by the enemy of Somalis. This is stoops. The people of Somalia are so angry.
Somali scholar Dr. Abdi Wahab Sheikh Abdi Samad says that the West has kept Somalis from holding a one-person, one-vote election, but that if they held one, the whole government would be swept out. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev.
On Wednesday, January 25th, the Public Safety Committee of the St. Louis Board of Aldermen resolved to hold a public hearing with the FBI and local police to demand accountability around the violent militarized raids on the Uhuru movement in North St. Louis last summer. The St. Louis Police Department cooperated with the FBI raids against leaders of the well-known North City Black Power Blueprint Program, which has built a farmer's market, community garden, a basketball court, and black women's doula trainings. This included a raid on the home of Uhuru Movement founder O'Malley Jatella, who is 81 years old. The raid sparked outrage from the members of the community who spoke out in the public safety meeting. On Friday, I spoke with Penny Hess, chairperson of the African People's Solidarity Committee, an organization of white people organizing in solidarity with the movement for the liberation of Africa and African people under the leadership of the Uhuru Movement, led by the African People's Socialist Party. Penny is one of the four unindicted co-conspirators identified in the violent simultaneous pre-dawn FBI raids on July 29, 2022.
Penny, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Some of Pacifica listeners may have heard about the FBI raids on the Uhuru Movement, on the African People's Socialist Party. Could you remind us about what happened this summer?
Yes. Well, the date was July 29th, Friday, July 29th, and coordinated raids at 5 a.m. Central Time in St. Louis also took place at 6 a.m. on the East Coast in St. Petersburg, Florida. And a total of 7 offices and homes of Uhuru Movement, African People's Socialist Party, and members were raided at the very same time, very violently, by the local police in both situations, in both cities, with the who worked together with the FBI to make this raid, with toting assault rifles, pointing them at the people, sending flashbang drones into the homes, into the offices, in some cases, numerous. I mean, you know, maybe 15 or 20 or more agents and cops were coming into the Uhuru House in St. Petersburg, Florida, which has been the center for African community resistance and organizing for over 30 years there. And here also in St. Louis, to the home of Chairman O'Malley Jatella and Deputy Chair Onus Inay Jatella, who coordinates the Black Power Blueprint that you just described a little bit of. And their home is very close to where those projects are, in the most impoverished neighborhood of St. Louis on the north side. Also raided were my home, and who I share with Kitty Riley, who's also a member of the African People's Solidarity Committee, also the home of Jesse. Jesse Neville and Amanda Carlozzi, who live upstairs from the Solidarity Center, which has a big banner that says Unity Through Reparations and is an organizing center in the white community, just with an outpouring of support that we've had from the very beginning. And, you know, we've been out there organizing and doing, going door to door, dropping flyers, and have just a continued support from the white community. There's like four key white neighborhoods right around where we are, just for ongoing support for the Black Power Blueprint and the Uhuru movement.
Recently, Chairman Amalia Yeshitela, the African People's Socialist Party, and your solidarity organizations, you have been alerting people about the fact that some indictments are on the way. Could you speak as much as you can about that?
We have indications that indictments are coming, and we don't know a lot more than that, but I can only say that the charges, they're not charges, but the implications are absolutely almost laughably absurd, but that this is what historically the FBI and the US government has done to African people, all the way back to the Marcus Garvey movement, through the Black Panther movement, in the 1960s until today. This is a continuation of COINTELPRO kind of attack against an African-led organization that is working for political and economic power in the hands of the African community.
These indictments have something to do with your alleged ties to Russia. Could you just explain that briefly?
Well, it is saying that the African People's Socialist Party came under the, quote, malign influence of an unregistered Russian agent who told the African People's Socialist Party to organize around a petition for calling on the United Nations to support that African people in this country meet the qualifications for genocide under the United Nations covenant. And actually, that was a petition on change.org put out by the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement that had 130,000 signatures. And after the FBI raids, change.org took that down. And that is another campaign that we're trying to take on. But to just say, when the whole question all the way back to Paul Robeson in 1951 was part of a team that took a petition to the United Nations then saying African people charge genocide. And there's a book called We Charge Genocide. I mean, to say that a Russian told, you know, an African liberation movement that they have faced genocide. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. And also the question of reparations, they are saying, and in elections, local elections, which the party has waged both in St. Louis and St. Petersburg, Florida, where the candidates run on platforms called Unity Through Reparations. So they're saying that the Russians said that, you know, told them to do that. And so it's absolutely racist. I just want to say that, you know, that it would say that, you know, that African people can't think for themselves and haven't always, you know, that every movement that they have raised up to actually bring power into the hands of that community has been crushed very violently and very viciously by this government. So Chairman Amalia Yeshitela is leading an incredible fight back. And we're, you know, we have a whole committee called Hands Off Uhuru, Hands Off Africa.
So the Hands Off Uhuru, Hands Off Africa campaign, tell us more about it and tell us how you're proposing to turn the table, so to speak, where if the state is indicting you, let's indict the state.
Exactly. Well, it's certainly what Chairman O'Malley has been leading on that. And, you know, the whole movement is based on that. And to just say that the Hands Off Uhuru, handsoffuhuru.org, please go there, because it has everything. It has scores of solidarity messages from other organizations. It has shows you all of the donors, you know, just laid out all of the people who have donated to the legal fund. It shows videos, audio, articles, pictures, I mean, it tells everything about it. And, you know, it lays the political basis for, you know, for this, for, like you're saying, turning the tables and putting the state on trial and calling on them to have to justify why the whole question of genocide has to be raised by African people, you know?
Now let's come back to St. Louis, Missouri. The Dred Scott City of Refuge Sanctuary City Resolution is something that's being proposed. Could you talk about the significance of the Board of Aldermen's resolve to hold public hearings with the FBI and local police to ask them about this past summer's raids?
Well, yes. And let me say, first of all, that, you know, I really have to salute the alderman of the 18th Ward, Jesse Todd, who has been a longtime African Liberation Movement fighter and who is actually a member, a lifetime member of the Uhuru Movement. And he is the one that introduced this bill, it's a resolution to the Public Safety Committee so that it could come to the entire Board of Aldermen. And that some people, some of us, and you know, he pushed for there to be a hearing last week, and we brought this Dred Scott City of Refuge resolution for the city of St. Louis to this board, and it had two things. One is that it basically calls on, which I think is very beautiful, and certainly in solidarity with all other City of Refuge resolutions for Indigenous people, immigrants, and everything. But it's also saying that it wants to call on the city to have a non-cooperation stand or commitment that the local police would not work with federal agencies on charges stemming from people working in the community for the betterment of their community. And that's all this is about. And so that was really important, but it was also the first time that members of the Uhuru Movement had been to the Board of Aldermen to really lay out what happened. So, you know, so there was the beautiful, beautiful resolution, which is an excellent statement that says that Dred and Harriet, his wife, Scott, had petitioned because they had been taken to Illinois, and in Illinois at that time in the 1840s was a quote free state, but then they were brought back, or somehow they ended up back in St. Louis, and they were calling for refuge in the city of St. Louis. But instead what happened was basically the Supreme Court of the United States said that no African person had rights that any white person had to respect. And so this is sort of in that, you know, right in front of the old courthouse, I would just say, here in St. Louis is a beautiful statue of Dred and Harriet Scott, you know, to remember that. And also on the steps of that old courthouse is where African people were sold, you know, into enslavement here. So, you know, it just has a lot of beautiful meaning in the city. And it's an opportunity for the city to sort of, you know, redeem itself, because it has many, many, many vicious attacks on African communities throughout its whole history up until now, which has had something that was like a let it rot policy to not put resources into Black communities to basically prime it for gentrification and to move the African community out. And what is so different about what the African People's Socialist Party is doing is that it is working to uplift the community, to bring some of the elements of what gentrification would mean to white people, but without moving people out, you know? And so you see people in the neighborhood, like, you know, wanting to just be part of this and bring business and do everything possible to make this a vibrant African community, as it actually once was many years ago. So, you know, this was brought before that committee, and it also, you know, it really alerted some of the aldermen that this had happened, you know, that these raids had happened, which maybe they didn't know about that much. I don't know. But, you know, but some people expressed a lot of shock that had happened. And so what was resolved was that, and through just the fierce, great leadership of Alderman Jesse Todd, who is so courageous to go, you know, go before this board and call for this. And basically what ended up out of that initial hearing was that there would be another hearing this week, and that the board would ask the FBI and a representative of the local police department to come, so that, you know, we could more present what had actually happened. So this is scheduled for Wednesday, the 1st of February at 1 p.m.
Could you then tell people how they can get involved? What should people be on the lookout for, and how can they get involved in supporting you?
Well, there's so many ways. I would definitely call on people to go to handsoffuhuru.org. There is an ability to sign up, to volunteer, and, you know, people would get back to you. And also for people in the white community, I would really urge them as well to go to uhurusolidarity.org. And the Uhuru Solidarity Movement is getting ready to have its annual convention on March 11th, which they could sign up there for, you know, on Zoom, or come to St. Louis. They really have to see these programs. When people see it, they are just blown away. They have never seen something like this that has been created from bottom up, you know, without the city doing it or anything. And it's very beautiful. So people could come to St. Louis in March for that. But I would definitely call on listeners in the Bay Area, where there is a strong Uhuru movement and Uhuru Furniture Store and Uhuru Foods, to, you know, sign up, go to uhurusolidarity.org and, you know, sign up for the convention or any other kind of work that you can do, or go to handsoffuhuru.org. There's so much going on with that committee. So there's just a lot to do, and it's very dynamic.
Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you need to say?
Well, I just want to, you know, say that, of course, this past weekend, I mean, we've just seen just another almost unspeakably hideous murder of a young African man, and that it is why people from the white community have to be organized under the leadership of an organization such as the Uhuru Movement that is working for power, working to make conditions in which nobody can come in to the community and start killing people, you know, and that people would have power over their lives, and that we have a job in the white community to fight for reparations and the right of African people to struggle to be free, and also to say that, you know, not under our watch, no attacks on Chairman Omali Yeshitela, the Uhuru Movement. We're not going to see a continuation of what happened to Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and people like Mutulu Shakur, who were in prison, you know, for 30, 40 years for fighting for freedom. And, you know, we want to build a serious movement of white people under the leadership of the African Revolution, and say also that we have a right to fight for reparations to African people. So thank you very much for having me on.
That was Penny Hess, chairperson of the African People's Solidarity Committee. For more information on how to get involved, visit handsoffuhuru.org.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
the great Nina Simone, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. In San Francisco, the International Longshore Workers Union, Local 10, has voted to close down all Bay Area ports on February 16th to demand the freedom of Mumia Abu-Jamal. They have also reached out to the largest union in Africa, the National Metal Workers Union of South Africa, to join the action. They will be picketing the U.S. Embassy in Johannesburg on February 16th to also demand the release of Mumia Abu-Jamal. They are urging unionists and locals throughout the U.S. and globally to join the action. Steve Zeltzer, reporting from Durban, South Africa, interviewed ILWU Local 10 member David Newton, the nephew of Black Panther founder Huey Newton, and Jack Heyman, a retired member of ILWU Local 10.
First, I'll invite Jack Heyman. Jack, why don't you talk about what's happening with Mumia and this International Day of Action, which is being worked on and acted on by the ILWU Local 10.
Sure. So, you know, the Longshore Union, and particularly Local 10, has been defending Mumia for over three decades now. And we feel this is the best opportunity now to finally free Mumia. And that's because of a judge's decision on December 16th, Judge Lucretia Clemens. And she made a decision which surprised so many of us, which was that all the boxes that had been sequestered, hidden really, in the district attorney's office has to be turned over to the defense of Mumia. And we already know one of the pieces of evidence is there's a handwritten message from the star witness, Robert Chaubert, the taxi driver, who said in the handwritten message to the district attorney, McGill at the time, I gave you the testimony, where's my money? That, it, to me, is conclusive that this is perjured testimony, and that alone should throw the case out, and Mumia should be free. I mean, there are so many discrepancies in terms of judicial misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct. They were excluding blacks from the jury. That's another thing that was found in these boxes. So there's enough material to prove that Mumia has been framed from the get-go. He spent 41 or 42 now, I think, years in prison. I visited him a couple of years ago. He's been having one medical condition after another. Heart problem, liver, had hepatitis C. These are all deadly diseases.
Also joining us is David Newton. David, why don't you talk about what's happening in the decision of the ILWU Executive Board, Local 10.
Mumia has been locked up for 41, almost 42 years now. And I said I'm not calling him that anymore. I'm calling him political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal because that's what he is and that's his name. The judge finally agreed to review his case and bring all of the boxes because we've been calling for a new trial for Mumia for 400 years, not just 41. That's a whole nother argument. But Mumia's case on December 16th, the judge said, let me review it. Will give me 60 days, which will come to February 16th. And then from February 16th to March 16th, she will render a verdict or a decision. So anytime after February 16th, this thing can come down. The action that we plan to take as ILWU members is we would like to stand down on the job because this is the power that we have. Now, me and my comrade, Big Brother Jack Heyman, are here in South Africa right now because we are also lobbying to our African sisters and brothers here who are also union brothers and sisters. Also, at the same time, a young man, Tyree, in Memphis is brutally beaten and murdered. So this is going on since we've been from Africa to this continent, to the United States. On my way to South Africa, a comrade of ours said that my people left, my ancestors left this continent that we're going to. So now we are here and we are networking with comrades of South Africa, Durban, Johannesburg. We're also talking to people from Namibia. We're talking to people from Rwanda. We're talking to people from England. We're trying to make this a global issue because being wrongfully persecuted, being wrongfully beaten, being wrongfully mistreated is a global human issue. So we're trying to get into the humanity. And if we can, as the working class people, unite on a larger scale, then we can actually make change and we can shake some trees and make some leaves fall down, because that's what we need to do. We don't have the economic capital or the economic power to put people in office, but we can make those people feel it, and then they'll maybe conform and feel a human side, because I saw a young boy be beaten, and I don't see enough outrage about this man that lost his life being punched like a punching bag, and all he did was be accused of reckless driving. I don't even know if that's the case. Maybe it was a hit. Maybe they went saw that young man and they had an issue with how he looked or smelled. It could have been as simple as that. We'll never know. But I want to say free Mumia, because now we can save a life. We just lost another life. We won't get that back. But we need some change. We need for those, call them whatever you want to call them. I don't know what kind of humans they were. But for those people, they're gone. But for the people behind them, maybe police people can have an 8-hour day and get paid an extra hour for counseling. I don't care if they get paid an extra hour for counseling, but they it would have to be a requirement. At home, we can have, in public schools, we should have training for these kids coming out of school and say, listen, these people may not be your friends if they're on the scene. You need to conduct yourself in this manner. We need to take methods of going forward to prevent these things from happening. Also, stand down work actions can put it in the pockets and make people feel it. So now we can actually touch people's homes, and this is our plan.
And this struggle for human rights, for worker rights, is an international struggle, as you're saying. It's all over the world. You've been here in South Africa, and you were visiting NUMSA, which is the largest union in South Africa. It's not only the largest union in South Africa, it's the largest union in Africa. And you met with the leadership, and they've decided to take an action here in South Africa in solidarity with Mumia Abu-Jamal. Why don't you talk about that, Jack?
We've been developing a close relationship with NUMSA in particular. NUMSA, the most militant and largest trade union in South Africa. We appealed to them several years ago when Mumia was dying of hepatitis C. They wrote a powerful letter to the governor of Pennsylvania at the time, Governor Wolf, that said, you, Governor Wolf, are treating Mumia Abu-Jamal, a political prisoner, the same way the apartheid regime treated our freedom fighters. When they got sick, they let him die a very lonely and painful death. Now, I can't say that it was that letter that turned the governor's head, but I'm sure it had some kind of influence in the decision, because Mumia was able to get the life-saving medication. And he, in breaking through that barrier, he was able to get that medication for all the 7,000 prisoners in Pennsylvania suffering from hepatitis C. Now, we've had this relationship with the NUMSA. We were coming here for a conference with the Durban dock workers, and also at the university with some professors here in Durban, the Durban.
So you met with the leadership. What did the leadership say at NUMSA?
We met with them at their headquarters. They had all of their national office bearers at the meeting with the staff. There wasn't an empty seat in the room. And we laid out the case for Mumia Abu-Jamal, and we showed them some of the videotapes of the militant actions that the ILWU has taken, starting with the strike against the apartheid ship that came in from South Africa in 1984. In 1999, we shut down all the ports on the West Coast to defend Mumia Abu-Jamal. And when they saw that, they realized, you know, we're here for more action to free Mumia. I laid out the basis for there's a real chance for Mumia to get free now, and we need unions like NUMSA, which not only are powerful in this country, but they have a big outreach to unions around the world. They're committed to having a demonstration at the U.S. Embassy on February 16th. As Newt said, that's the 60 days from when she made her decision. After that, she'll have 30 days to finally make her decision.
So you're urging workers around the world. I understand there's going to be a demonstration also in Japan and Tokyo.
It's going to start out in Tokyo. That will be the first demonstration. We're at this point reaching out to workers in India and Pakistan. We haven't heard back yet. The next would be South Africa. And South Africa is appealing to Unite. Unite is the largest trade union in Britain, 1.2 million members.
So what does this mean? I mean, this would be an international action for Mumia. demanding that he be released. Do you think that this kind of political action by workers around the world should increase? And what does it mean politically? I mean, the murders in the United States, ongoing murders of blacks, it seems like there's no stopping. Every day there's another murder, there's massacres, and the U.S. government is allowing mass distribution of guns, machine guns. I mean, every time there's a massacre, they're selling more guns. I get ads for more guns in the mail. I mean, it's a business. It seems like it's a business of murder, business of mass hysteria.
Yeah, well, you hit the nail on the head. It is a business of murder. And what the world is saying in opposition to that is we don't agree. Shout out to Big Sister Angela Davis wrote a personalized letter to the General Secretary of NUMSA to demand Mumia's release. We are not accepting this. We've never accepted it, and we will not continue to accept it. And now what we plan to do is strengthen ourselves for this war that we are in, because call it what it is. You're talking about dealing guns, buying guns, putting people in position to be murdered and lose their lives. And it's not just because you lost your life under a gun. Mumia has lost 42 years in a cell. So that's another way of taking someone's life. We want this man to be free. We want justice for Tyree. And beyond justice, we don't want these things to happen anymore. So this is the foundation that we are building on. This is the foundation that we will continue to lay until we see better.
We feel that this is the best opportunity right now to free Mumia, with international mobilizations taking place. We feel that if Mumia is given a fair opportunity, that the judge really looks at what the evidence shows, that he'll be free. And we are reaching out to the audience in LA as well. We're going to have demonstrations up in the Bay Area in San Francisco on February 6th.
You're going to be marching from your union hall to Harry Bridges Plaza at the Ferry Building. You're urging trade unions to join you at noon at the Ferry Building.
No, at noon at our union hall.
And you're urging other workers, dock workers in Los Angeles, as the largest local 13.
All workers and people of color. We're not only marching to free Mumia Abu-Jamal, we've added a clause because of this vicious killing of Tyre Nichols. By the way, we've talked about this earlier, by five black cops. And I think Clarence said it most eloquently in Panther language, a pig is a pig is a pig. So.
Yeah, and I would like to add on to that, that we're talking about economic oppression against the people, and people are labeling these cops as humans. They are not humans to me. I don't see five black cops. I don't see five white cops. I see five blue cops that are renegades against social people. We need these people off of the streets. These are the worst kind of criminals, and we do not humanize animals, so let's not humanize these monsters.
Those were ILWU Local 10 member David Newton, the nephew of Black Panther founder Huey Newton, and Jack Heyman, a retired member of the ILWU Local 10, in conversation with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer in Durban, South Africa.
Homeland in hip-hop. To think about the origins of hip-hop in this culture, and also about homeland security, is to see that there are, at the very least, two worlds in America. One of the well-to-do, and another of the struggling. For if ever there was the absence of homeland security, it is seen in the gritty roots of hip-hop. For the music arises from a generation that feels, with some justice, that they have been betrayed by those who came before them, that they are, at best, tolerated in schools, feared on the streets, and almost inevitably destined for the hellholes of prison. They grew up hungry, hated, and unloved. And this is the psychic fuel that generates the anger that seems endemic in much of the music and poetry. One senses very little hope above the personal goals of wealth to climb above the pit of poverty. In the broader society, the opposite is true. For here, more than any other place on earth, wealth is so widespread and so bountiful that what passes for the middle class in America could pass for the upper class in most of the rest of the world. Their very opulence and relative wealth makes them insecure, and homeland security is a governmental phrase that is as oxymoronic, as crazy as, say, military intelligence or the U.S. Department of Justice. They're just words that have very little relationship to reality. Now, do you feel safer now? Do you think you will anytime soon? Do you think duct tape and Kleenex and color codes will make you safer? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Immortal Technique, Homeland and Hip Hop, featuring Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. New College of Florida student activists are organizing against the hostile takeover of the school's board of trustees by ultra-right-wing Ron DeSantis appointees. Ali Abdul-Kader of the show Ruthless Truth on WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, has this story.
Ron DeSantis has recently appointed six new members to the New College Board of Trustees, New College being right here in Sarasota, of course. These six members are right-wing conservatives, and they've announced their intent to restructure the New College as it exists right now, erase it of its progressive elements, and generally make it conform to the kind of attack that we've seen from DeSantis on education across the state with the Stop Woke Act and the Don't Say Gay Bill. Right here on The Ruthless Truth, we are joined by two student activists who are helping to organize a student and faculty fight back against this attack by Ron DeSantis. So I'm very happy to be joined by guests Sam Scharf. Sam, welcome to The Ruthless Truth.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for covering our story.
Of course. And Lex Daly.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you both for taking the time to come on. I know you've been very busy lately trying to get all the students together and organized to be able to fight back against this hostile takeover is what it is in reality. So I was wondering, could y'all kind of lay down a little bit more info on what has happened? Who are these right-wing members of the New College Board and what do they want to do exactly?
We have a whole plethora of reactionary ideologues put on our board who all share similar views on what ideal education should be, such as like removal of anything that teaches America's racist history or like any queer studies or feminist studies or anything critical of like the state in general or anything critical of capitalism they want removed too. And they have expressed this in their own statements over the years. The most prominent one is Mr. Rufo, who took to Twitter to make fun of me, which I thought was pretty funny.
Right. Could you talk about that? What did he say exactly on Twitter? Because I remember seeing that.
So I was interviewed by the Daily Beast and they asked me how I felt when the story came out. And I told them I was out surfing and then I got sad and then laid on the beach once I found out. And then Rufo and his friends saw that quote and thought it was super duper funny how I got sad and laid down. So they just started like sharing it everywhere.
I'm sorry, but that is really pathetic from somebody who's going to be on the New College Board of Trustees, right? To be just like quoting one of the students that they're supposed to be having a stake in making sure feels safe and is getting a good education at their school, and they're just mocking them on Twitter. I think that's really disgusting, and
yeah,
it shows.
He also was mocking another student who was quoted too, so he's not a very nice individual.
I want to say that I think this just shows that all six of these new trustees, with I guess the exception of the NCF alum who graduated in 1980, Deborah Jenks, but the majority of these people don't really know anything about our school or have any true connection to it. They just kind of view us as the blueprint or the building ground for this ideological like reconfiguration of public education across Florida and across the country. We're being targeted because we represent to them everything that's wrong with liberal arts colleges today. They don't know anything about how academically rigorous our curriculum is or how successful our students and alumni are, and especially how diverse we are as a community in our different ideologies, faiths, political practices. They just don't know anything about our school. Rufo lives in Washington. He's never been to our campus before. Like, what's his stake in this besides doing some sort of publicity stunt? Because that's all that he's been doing so far, as well as just kind of making targets out of our students and just making all these grandiose statements about these great changes that he wants to make to the curriculum when it's really not even something that a board member is supposed supposed to be talking about or planning outside of the meetings, according to our student members of the board. So he's already sort of engaging in really inappropriate and unlawful behavior as a board member. And again, that's just exemplifying how little Rufo knows about his actual position and how little he knows about the school.
I think it also goes to show just how little they care about the current rules and procedures of this board. I think DeSantis elected these people for a purpose, and that's to kind of make an example out of New College. New College, of course, being the most progressive university in the Florida state college system. And I think they absolutely are trying to make an example out of it and to really show that if they could attack New College. And I want to kind of lay out some of the things that he said. So he said that he wants to shutter any diversity, equity, and inclusion related programs at the school. He deems them unnecessary, and instead promoting values like colorblindedness, which just means ignoring systemic injustices with the intent of excluding minorities from the student body and staff, colorblindedness, merit, and I believe the other one was equality. So it's just trying to flip these values on their head. And it's obviously a dog whistle, but the other things that he said is he's planning on completely, along with the rest of the board, redesigning the core curriculum of the school. They're certainly going to strip it of its progressive elements and its principles, and they want to bring in new faculty to help with this transition, and they want that faculty to be trained and have the values of sort of American exceptionalism, free enterprise, which is just a catchphrase to mean that they're pro-capitalism, pro-unfettered capitalism. And I believe the other ones were religious freedoms, but basically you can see what he's trying to do here, right? He's trying to completely flip the current curriculum on its head, bring in conservative professors, completely strip the curriculum of any sort of critical component, anti-racist, anti-capitalist, or showing the flaws of our current system right now. I think that's what he's trying to do. Whether or not he'll be successful, that remains to be seen. But I was wondering, what is at risk here? You guys are New College students, so I was wondering if you could tell me, what is at risk if they are successful with this agenda?
So I want to start off by saying that this has already harmed our student body. Rufo specifically has talked about wanting to use these goals to increase enrollment and improve our school. But according to the admissions office, there's already been a number of students calling to ask to unenroll and have their deposits back because they're fearful of these changes to the school. There are already people working hard to get more students enrolled in New College, and it's been working. Like, our enrollment rate has been increasing, and now some of that work that our students and our faculty have been doing to make that happen has been reversed by these frankly frightening new changes and statements made by some of the new board members. What makes New College special is the academic rigor and the wide array of values and ideals that the students have. But we also have a number of students belonging to like queer and other marginalized communities on campus. We have a high number of disabled students, and people come here because they know it's a safe haven and a safe space for them, especially in the public university system in Florida. Like, as somebody who was a transfer student. I went to community college in South Florida before transferring to New College, and I felt like my beliefs and my identity had to be censored to feel safe on campus. And that was never the case at New College. And we are all, I think, definitely fearful of that becoming the case at our school, which was such a special and safe haven for people of all identities to be open and feel respected and heard on campus. And, you know, our school isn't perfect. There's always been continuing issues with that, but we don't want any of that progress that we have a student body has been making to get reversed by these people. And it seems like, you know, they don't know anything about our school and they just want to do this as a political stunt, especially because, you know, a lot of these people are senior folks at conservative think tanks that are backed by a lot of money and give a lot of money to like people like DeSantis's campaigns. So there's a profit incentive here, too, that I think we need to talk about for sure.
What has been the kind of reaction from students at New College so far? What has been the reaction to these board members and their announced intentions for the school, students and faculty?
It seems to me like everyone has really just been throwing their weight in to see what they can do to resist this. It's actually been really inspiring to see. I've been going here for like 3 years and I haven't felt as unified between like students and staff as I have in this last week, just because everyone is really, really scrambling to get groups together to have things in place for us to really build a powerful movement to frankly save our school, because that's what we feel like we're doing. We know that if this board ends up happening the way way DeSantis and, you know, people like Rufo wanted to go, like our school will be a completely different place within the next couple of months, years, whatever. And New College has been an important part of the Sarasota and greater Florida community since 1960. Like, we can't let this happen without putting up a fight.
I would agree with what Lex said. A lot of people are also like trying to figure out how they can be involved and how they can help. And a lot of parents and faculty and community members are all just, how can we organize to save the school? There's a whole kind of united coalition forming because no one wants to see this happen.
We have called for a united front of solidarity and support across the college. We want to prevent employment decisions like hiring and firing, benefits and tenure that impact faculty, staff, or student workers from being made on political grounds, because we all know that this is purely a political move. We want to protect LGBTQ+, BIPOC, and disabled members of the NCF community through explicit protections for existing diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, gender studies coursework, our living learning communities. We have Africana and Pride LLCs, which are different sort of housing communities that are available to students, and any other threatened programming. We do want to see current members of the board or other administration provide explicit protection. And there have also been some alumni and community organizations that have been reaching out to sort of help us get that into motion.
I think there's a lot of narrative going around right now saying, like, don't worry, these people can't actually achieve these things in the institution. They're going to be blocked. Maybe they're willing to work with our faculty and not do bad things. But these people are just pure ideologues. They're not just looking for like a seat of power. They're looking to actually radically change society in their direction. And they shouldn't be underestimated. And with that, we need to understand that only we can fight to organize and resist them. We can't just wait for administration to make backroom deals with them to try and stop the bleeding or hope that they come to compromises that don't actually harm us. Like, no, these people can never be appeased. They can't be stopped institutionally. They can only be stopped by organizing and people power, power of the students, the faculty, you know, the staff on school, workers, parents, the community overall has to form some sort of united coalition to stop this, because that's the only way that we could have a successful movement to save this school. And it's definitely not an easy task going up against an authoritarian state that doesn't follow rules and quote unquote normalcies and whatnot. You know, it's a very difficult task, but we will try our best, and we have been given a platform on the national stage, so we will use that to advocate for what we believe in and to advocate for our school and the students that go here. People can connect with us on social media platforms. So our Twitter and Instagram are called NCFEDUFreedom.
I do want to plug that it is public information when the Board of Trustees meeting happened. It is on the New College of Florida website. Currently, the first one is planned for the 31st of January, and there is a public comment section at the end.
We just heard from New College Florida student activists Sam Scharf and Lex Daly in conversation with host Ali Abdelkader on The Ruthless Truth from Pacifica affiliate WSLR in Sarasota, Florida. Maximum Respect for You by Lobo Loco. U.S. drone strikes regularly hit Somalia, an East African nation situated on some of the world's most geostrategic trade routes. The U.S. says it's drone bombing to eliminate the terrorist group Al-Shabaab, but it's failed so miserably for 13 years that many, if not most Somalis, believe that Al-Shabaab is just an excuse for U.S. military presence. In 2022, the U.S. kept Somalia from instituting universal suffrage and re-electing a hugely popular president who was trying to build a sovereign military. Pacifica's Ann Garrison has more.
The Federal Republic of Somalia has the longest coastline in Africa. Some estimate that it has the world's largest untapped coastal oil reserves, and it sits near the geostrategic waterways that 40% of the world's oil passes through every day. It also has five ports at the interface between Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. In 2022, the U.S. and its allies prevented Somalia from instituting universal suffrage and engineered the defeat of President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, a.k.a. Farmaajo, who was trying to build a military capable of defending Somalia's sovereignty. I spoke to Dr. Abdiwahab Sheikh Abdisamad about how that happened. Dr. Abdiwahab is a Somali-Kenyan, the executive director of the Institute for Horn of Africa Studies, and an expert in conflict resolution and rural development. In September 2021, he was abducted in Nairobi and held for 12 days for speaking out in support of then-President Farmaajo.
If today election is called for one man, one vote, the current crop of politicians, no one comes back. No one.
They would all be out.
No one comes back to power. All of them, those in parliament and those in executive, no one comes back because these people is being handpicked by the enemy of Somalis. This is a stooge. The people of Somalia are so angry. In fact, the Western world, we call the democracy world, they refuse Somalis to conduct 1-1-1-1 vote so that the Somali society can choose their own leaders. They can elect their own leaders. They don't want it. The excuse is only Al-Shabaab is there. That's an exaggerated, you know, statement. 40 to 50% of Somali population today, they are living in urban centers and refugee camps. They can elect anyone they want. In Mogadishu, in Baidawa, in Kismayo, in Garowe, in Baladwine, in Kalkayo, people, they can easily elect their own leaders. But unfortunately, multinational companies together with the Western world, they are not willing to do that. Because if they did that, all these politicians, the handpicked, will never come back to the Villa Somalia. Simple as that.
Okay, I want to stop and emphasize this. The so-called democratic world, the Western world that claims to promote democracy all over the world, has kept Somalia from having a one-person, one-vote electoral system because that would end the clan-based politics that they've been able to compromise. If Somalia had a one-person, one-vote election, the clan parliamentarians and executive branch would all be gone. They'd all be swept out of power. And you've told me that the previous president, Farmaajo, would be elected in a landslide.
I have no doubt in my mind that if today's election is called based on 1-1-1 vote, Farmaajo will be the landslide. I'm telling you, no question about that. But unfortunately, the Western world was against him. Multinationals was against him. Some clerics was against him as well. So the current crop of politicians, as we speak right now, is being handpicked by the enemies of Somalis. They don't have a vision and mission for the society.
How did that election last year, the election that Americans should understand was a clan-based election, not a one-person, one-vote election, how did the U.S. help to engineer President Farmaajo's defeat in that election? Multiple sources have reported that there was a lot of bribery involved.
Let me tell you, the regional member states are working for Western world. They are the one who handpicked the members of parliament, not people, they never elected any one of them. Mm-hmm. People, they never elected any one of them. Mm-hmm. The regional member states, they handpicked each and every member of parliament based their own interest. Some of them is being financed by the foreign countries. In fact, the foreign countries, specifically there are some Arab countries, are paying some money, bribing the what you call the local elders to elect so and so and so, so that the clan elder will receive some money. Mm-hmm. So money change hands. That's why most of the members of parliament today is being financed by the foreign countries. So they are there for the interests of the foreign countries rather than the interests of their own people. Sorry to say that. It's a fact. It's a fact. The regional member states like Puntland, like Jubaland, like Somaliland to some extent, like Galmudug, Hirshabelle, Southwest, the leaders of those regional member states are the one who, in fact, electing the members of parliament based their own loyalties, financed by the foreign countries. So what we have seen right now is a foreign sponsor members of parliament who can serve the interests of the foreigners rather than the interests of their own people.
That was Dr. Abdiwahab Sheikh Abdisamad on how the U.S. thwarted universal suffrage in Somalia. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt, Polina Vasilyev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.